welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. Stories for entrepreneurs and artists who share their stories as we discuss everything storytelling. I'm Gemma Rosenthal.
And I'm Chris Sissons. On today's show, we explore anxiety and confidence, trusting in the flow, and new life stirring in Sheffield.
And this time, we're delighted to introduce our guest, Paul Wilson. Paul is a hypnotist and coach specializing in eliminating imposter syndrome, procrastination, overwhelm, and perfectionism. Hi, Paul. Welcome to
the podcast. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I feel like you may have called me out a little bit, though, because I feel like I was saying this to Chris. Imposter syndrome, procrastination, overwhelm, and perfectionism. These are all things that I've definitely struggled with in the past and can totally relate to, still sometimes have it. So if you could explain a little bit more, what do each of these things mean, first of all, for any of our listeners that may not be familiar with the terms?
Okay, procrastination. I found a brand new word, which I absolutely adore, procrasti-working. So we're talking to entrepreneurs. Procrasti working for an entrepreneur is, let me give you an example. This person should be doing outreach to find potential clients. But instead of doing that, they are procrasti working by fiddling with their logo or rewriting an email or fiddling with stuff instead of doing the thing they know they should be doing. So that's procrastination, procrasti working. And there's lots of reasons why that happens. Overwhelm. Well, basically, this is so simple. This is trying to eat the elephant in one sitting. When, you know, we just, oh my God, I've got this to do, and I've got that to do, I've got the other to do. I need to go see this person, I need to ring that person, I've got 15 emails, I've got boom, they just explode. Perfectionism, well, people chase this, but the thing is, there's no such thing as perfectionism. And I'll give you another example. I'm a photographer by passion, by hobby, by interest, and I love taking photographs. You can learn, you can put 100 photographers on the same beach in front of the same sunset, and each one of those people will say to you, well, I wish there was a boat here. Actually, I wish the sun was just a little bit more orange. I wish there was a beautiful girl in the middle. So you're going to get 100 different definitions and impressions and views of that sunset. So perfection is in the mind, and I firmly believe that it's actually impossible to achieve. Now, there's nothing wrong with striving for perfection as long as you know when to stop. But for a lot of entrepreneurs, it kind of flips into procrasti working again. Because instead of doing the thing, like launching the thing they want to do, they're tweaking the website, they're getting the business cards just absolutely perfectly right. And so again, they're putting off the thing they need to do. So in a nutshell, that's the three things: perfectionism, overwhelm, and procrastination.
And imposter syndrome was the other one.
Imposter syndrome. Well, those three are kind of symptoms of imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome itself is a symptom of something that usually happened 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago or during someone's childhood. We've all been told you're not good enough. You'll never amount to anything. You're hopeless. No, 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 no. We get taught this over and over and over again. And so when you want to go live on Facebook or stand up on stage or write that book, you get these thoughts coming through your head. You know what? Who are you to do that? People are going to laugh at you. You're worthless. You're hopeless. You'll never do it. You haven't got the skills. And for me, it's the disconnect. Imposter syndrome is a disconnect between your experience, your knowledge, your expertise, all that stuff you fought hard to gain, and the thing you want to achieve. There's like this little ugly thing, this barrier comes up to separate those two things together. And my job is to find out the root cause that's creating that barrier and collapse it so you can rejoin your experience, expertise, knowledge, and skills to the thing that you want to do.
Amazing. So how do you go about finding that root cause?
Okay, so imagine you're an explorer and you've sailed across an ocean and you approach this brand new land that nobody's ever seen before. And right on the coastline, there's an opening, which is a river, and you want to discover the source of that river. So you sail your boat down the river and the river gets narrower and narrower and narrower. until it's so narrow you have to get off the boat and start walking. And you're climbing through cliffs, you're hacking your way through jungle, walking through waterfalls, until one day you approach this savannah, this beautiful, peaceful area, and you get close and close to this rocky outcrop, and that's the source of the river. And what I do is I work with my clients to discover the root cause or the source of the imposter syndrome.
Okay. And what do you find out of the clients that you've worked with, what are the most common root causes? Is it something to do with childhood, or can it be something else?
A lot of the time it's childhood related. A lot of the time it's when people blame themselves for events that were completely out of their hands. This reminds me of a client who, when she was, 8, 9, 10, 11, she'd asked for a brand new bicycle for Christmas. And the parents have got this brand new bicycle, yet within about a month, bailiffs came knocking on the door, took everything away from the house that could be carried away, and the parents' business went bankrupt. And unbeknownst to my client, she had taken responsibility for that bankruptcy based on the fact that she'd asked for a bicycle. And now she'd completely forgotten about this until we did the work. And the problem was that this forgotten memory was stopping her from going into business and making money because she felt she didn't deserve it. And the reason why she didn't deserve it was hidden away in this root cause of the purple pink bicycle.
Wow. Yeah, I do something called family constellations therapy. I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically it's about going back to understanding that you're part of a system, and that sometimes you can take on other people's stuff. So it might be something that your dad's going through or something your mum's going through. And then it's almost like the child, it could be an adult child, but, you know, takes on that responsibility. And it's interesting that you said that's a similar kind of thing with the bike, is that that child was taking on the responsibility that wasn't theirs.
And I think they were taking on the blame for the bankruptcy. And I completely agree with you. A lot of problems that adults face today stem from childhood or early youth. Absolutely.
It's making me reflect on, whenever I'm talking to a guest, I'm always thinking, how can this help me? And then I get too personal. So then it's probably best if Chris speaks first.
Yeah. Well, I love the analogy of the following the river to the source. And chances are I might steal it. You know, like Oscar Wilde. I wish I'd said that. You will, Oscar. You will. But one of the things I find is that there's a positive side to this as well, because very often somebody's passion, the thing that they really enjoy doing, that they've developed expertise and skills, when you look at their life, there's a thread going all the way back to childhood, and they can actually follow that thread and see how their how their skill and their passion has developed.
Yeah, and that's with the storytelling, isn't it, as well? Finding the stories that get us to from where we were to where we are now. And do you have any stories, Paul, about clients that you've had who've gone through that transformation, who you've worked with, and where they are now and where they've come from?
Oh, yeah, too many to mention. One of my favourite stories is actually not from a client, but it's someone, I've got my own podcast, and it's someone I interviewed about 2 years ago. This lady is South African, and I think she was in Johannesburg, and she was around about kind of 50 when this happened. It was in the evening, and she was working alone in her print room, and a guy that she knew came in, attacked her, raped her, beat her until he thought she was dead, and ran away. He was caught and put in prison. This person left South Africa and went to work in another country for 8 or 9 years, and then decided that she'd had enough of this country and came back to South Africa. Coincidentally, the guy that had attacked her was coming up for parole, and in South Africa, the victims of people like this chap are allowed to go to the parole hearing to say their piece. And so she was invited and said, yeah, I'll come along. So we get to the parole hearing. The guy says his piece. The judge says his piece. He turns to this lady and goes, "Do you have anything you'd like to say?" And she goes, "Yes, sir, I've got one thing to say." And she looks at the guy directly, eye to eye contact. She goes, "I forgive you." To me, that is one of the most powerful things I've ever, ever heard. She forgave this guy, not via an email, not via a letter, not via, you know, kind of a Zoom or Zencast kind of thing, actually face to face, literally about 10 feet from this guy who had actually physically beat her and left her for dead. She says, "I forgive you." And she's built a whole brand new life based around that feeling and that belief and that incredible power and courage to actually say that. And I just find that unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah, we had a similar guest talk about being raped and going through that when she was younger, and how she's now joined the Forgiveness Project, which is a book on forgiveness as well. And that was Madeline Black, and you can listen to her story on, I can't remember what episode it was. It was one of the early ones we did. But it's incredible when you hear these stories where people have gone through such brutality, and you just think, how do they do it? And do you have any insight on how it works in the mind, just from the coaching and hypnotist perspective? How does forgiveness work when it comes to like a neurological process, or is it more spiritual?
I think it's a combination, actually. Someone who's been through something like this and is able to genuinely and honestly forgive someone, I believe it comes down to a decision. Because we can spend the rest of our life being a victim of circumstance, wrong place, wrong time kind of thing, or we can say, you know what, that was horrible and I will not wish it on anyone, but I'm going to grow from this and become a different person, a better person as a result of this happening to me. And I truly believe it's a mindset thing. Someone actually makes a conscious choice to live a better life. And rather than be that person's victim for the rest of their lives, they go, you know what? That was enough. I've grieved enough. I've gone on enough. End of story. And I'm going to move forward with my life. So I really believe it's actually a decision, a mental process that people go through. And yeah, it's partly spiritual. It's partly just mindset, a lot of thought, a lot of deep thought has to go in before someone can make that decision. Because again, it has to come from a place of real, total honesty and power and courage.
Yeah, because it's not something you can do straight away normally. And it's also something, it's really important to feel the feelings as well of you know, to not just jump straight to forgiveness. Yeah, I forgive you, unless it's actually a genuine process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There has to be time to grieve. I'm not saying that someone, you know, goes through something horrible and goes, "Yo, great, thank you very much. I'm fine now. Yeah, whoop, let's get on with days. I forgive you." No, there's a process of recovery, physical recovery and mental recovery. And this can take a day, a month, a decade. Every single person is different. Some people never recover from this, never. And yet other people, you know, they can just go, you know what, I've had enough now. I've had enough grieving. I've had enough suffering. I want to move on with my life.
What difference does it make if they actually say, "I forgive you," to the person who harmed them? I mean, if they forgive them, do they have to do that? I mean, for example, the person who harmed them might die in the meantime, so it may not be possible. But even if it is possible, is it an essential part of forgiveness? And if it's optional, what does it add?
I don't think it's an essential part, but I think it demonstrates to the person themselves that they have truly forgiven. Because some victims of horrible things can never face that person again, can never face their attacker again. So it takes a tremendous amount of courage to actually stand face to face with that person and say those words. And I think that's the big difference, is that somebody can do that for themselves. It just demonstrates that, yeah, they really have forgiven and they really want to move on with their lives.
Is it time to hear Paul's story, Gemma?
Yeah. Paul, we'd love to hear your story now.
Okay. I've got lots and lots of stories to share, but I've thought of one in particular, because we are told that strangers are dangerous and we should stay away from strangers. We should avoid strangers. We shouldn't come into contact with strangers. And I'm not just talking about when we're kids, but also as adults, we should avoid eye contact. We don't get into conversation and all this kind of thing. And I find that astounding, because I have been helped so many times by strangers that I've forgotten how many times. In the 80s, I used to hitchhike a lot. I spent a lot of time in Europe. Summer season, by the beach, working on campsites, winter seasons, working in ski resorts. And in between times, I would travel around by hitchhiking usually. And this one particular occasion, I had finished a winter season in Switzerland, and I was traveling through Yugoslavia, because at the time I'm talking, it was still known as Yugoslavia, and down into mainland Greece, and I was island hopping. So I'd jump on a ferry, get off, spend a few days or a few weeks on an island, and then jump on another ferry or get a lift on a fishing boat or something. This one particular time, I was on, I think it was Crete, but I'm not exactly sure. And it had been a long day. It was a beautiful, beautiful evening. The sun was starting to come down, and I'd been walking and walking and walking for, I don't know, God knows how long. Anyway, I'm heading down this hill towards the harbour, where there's a little fishing boat and a small ferry kind of goes every couple of hours to the next island. And I'm walking down there, and I notice on my left-hand side, there's something slightly bigger than a shepherd's hut. And there's an old guy sat outside with a table, another chair, and a bottle of ouzo and some olives on the table. And I'm walking along, and I'm about to kind of go, you know, nod my head and say hello. And he looks at me, and he beckons me over in American English. He goes, yeah, hi, buddy, come over, come and have a drink. So first of all, I'm astounded, because this is, I'm in the middle of nowhere, and this guy's speaking English with a brilliant accent, and he's about, I don't know, 75, 80 years old, something like this. And I went, yeah, great, thanks. So I walk across his threshold, and he says, yeah, grab a chair, and we sit down. And he says, look, have a drink, have some olives, help yourself. And we start talking. And there's me presuming that this guy's a local villager that he's lived here all his life, and just shows how wrong it can be. This guy was a former captain of tankers and cargo boats. He was a marine skipper, and he spent his whole life at sea. Because for those of you that don't know, Greece is a huge shipping country. Yeah, they've got millions and millions of boats all around the world. And Piraeus, which is the massive harbour outside of Athens, is like one of the busiest harbours in the world. Anyway, we're talking, and he's sharing his stories about his life at sea and how, you know, he'd met really famous people, really wealthy people, really, you know, incredible people. But he decided in his retirement that he was going to retire to this tiny little cottage just above the port, because he liked his solitude and he liked his peace and quiet, but he still liked to be able to watch the boats going in and out the harbour. And we're sitting there and we're chatting, and he's offering me food and everything. And he starts to ask me about my journey and what I'm doing here and what my plans are. And it's such a beautiful moment, because there is no agenda on either side. It's just two people sitting down, having a conversation over a glass of wine and some olives. And time flies by, and I notice that it is starting to get dark. I said, well, I better go now, because I need to get a ferry across to the next island. And he looks up and he goes, ah, you've missed it, my friend, because the last one leaves at, I don't know, 7 o'clock. So that's a bit of a bummer. I said, no problem. Look, you know, you've got a sleeping bag in that rucksack of yours. I guess you can keep on the floor. And so I spent the night until it got really, really dark, sitting and chatting with this gentleman. And then when it gets too dark, he says, okay, I'm off to bed now. Here's a candle. You can sleep here. In the morning, I wake up and there's cheese and bread and olives and more wine and honey. And we sit down there and have this magnificent breakfast. And he says, you know what? I fancy a walk down to the harbour. Come with me and I'll get you on a boat. You don't need to pay for the ferry. I'll find you somebody that's going across the next island. And so we finish breakfast and we take a gentle stroll down into the small little fishing village harbour, come port. It's kind of a mixture of everything. And we get down there, and by the time we hit kind of the first house, people are coming outside and going, you know, hello, Stavros. That's not his name, but hello, Stavros. How are you doing? Because I didn't speak Greek apart from, you know, a few, like Eferisto, Parakalo, and stuff like that. But everybody's coming out and saying hello, good morning, shaking hands. And it takes us literally about, I don't know, half an hour, three quarters of an hour to get down to the to where the boats are. And eventually we make it down, and he's waving at people, and he calls people over, and he has these conversations. And essentially what's going on is he's asking them where they're going and when they're going and if they've got space for somebody else. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is incredible. I only met this guy last night, complete strangers, and yet here he is putting himself out, organizing a ride for me to the next island. And I've got so many stories like this. It's just incredible. People that have, you know, when I've been hitchhiking, been pouring down with rain, I'm actually soaked to the skin. My rucksack is just completely full of water. And people stop and give me lifts and feed me and put me up for the night. It's incredible. I mean, I have been given lifts in cars that were chauffeur driven. I've been in cars where I've had to get out and push. I've been invited to spend the night in luxurious mansions and also slept in shepherd huts. I've also slept under motorway bridges and dined on food I've taken out of the bin. And yet I've been fed sumptuous meals. I've dined with the rich, the poor, and the dying. And I just find it incredible, the generosity of strangers. And even today, it still happens. Two or three days ago, I was sitting at my window watching the world go by. It was pouring with rain. And this chap comes along, slips and falls over. I'm about to rush up and get a render aid. Before I can even get up, there are four people around this guy giving him first aid, calling an ambulance. Complete strangers getting soaked to the skin to help this one person. So I find it really, I've got past annoying now because I understand why people feel this way, but I just find it incredible that we still have this fear of strangers when we're not strangers. We inhabit this tiny little insignificant rock at the back end of a tiny little insignificant galaxy amongst billions, trillions of galaxies. We are all neighbors. We all come from the same stock. And in a sense, none of us are strangers. And that's the end of my story.
Thank you. I was going to give you a clap. Yeah, I love that you focused your story on others. That's really nice. I mean, it is wonderful when people come on and tell their personal story, but I quite like that you chose to sort of focus on the kindness of others, because that is really refreshing and nice.
Well, the challenge is that when you invite people onto podcasts and you go to networking meetings, all this kind of thing, it's all me, 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 me. Buy my thing. I'm wonderful. I do this. I do that. Let me share my story about how incredible I am. Well, excuse my language, that's bollocks. We are here to serve. We are here to help other people. And the more people you help, the bigger your network becomes. You can help more people. And yeah, okay, it's great when somebody comes to work with me and they pay me money, but I still work with the odd person for free, you know, if they need it. And in a way, for me, it's a kind of, I don't know, paying it forward, because like I said to you a few minutes ago, I've lost count of the people that have actually helped me in lots of different ways. And so I just see it as a way of paying back.
Yeah, I think it's... We're always taught to sort of make it all about us and, you know, market yourself through yourself and what you do. And I fall into that sometimes, and it's okay. But, like, it's just, it's good to learn how to turn it around and think, well, who is it that I'm serving and what might they want to hear today and, you know, what might be useful. How can I help is something that I've been talking about. I just posted actually this morning a video on community and asking that question, like, how can we help each other? And just talking about the nice things that happen in Sheffield and my community and the people that I've met and just different just moments, because it's nice to remind ourselves that we're not alone and that there are strangers that will help us. Like you said, like something I mentioned in the video was that I went down to my local shop the other day and they were actually shut. They weren't open, but they let me in anyway because they were just there. So they thought, well, we're not open, but we can serve you because, you know, you're here and you want to be served. So I just think it's things like that where, you know, people just helping out that make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be perfectly frank with you, it's people don't want to hear about you or me or Chris or anybody. They want to hear about themselves and what's in it for them. So if you kind of go off telling people how amazingly, wonderful, incredibly fantastic you are, people switch off because that is irrelevant. What people want to know is, can you help me? How can you help me? When can you help me? And do I need to pay for it, in a nutshell? And that's what it's all about. So if you go spouting off about yourself and your skills and this and that and the other, unless you're in an interview, you're just wasting your breath. And that's why when you go to networking meetings and people do this 60 seconds about them, people aren't listening. They're checking their phones, they're writing notes, they're chatting to the person next door. And it's only when it's their turn to speak do they stand up and expect everyone to pay them attention.
It's something I find when I'm not checking my notes and fiddling around with my phone and do listen, I find mostly people talk about solutions. And they very rarely talk about problems. And I was talking to a business just a couple of weeks ago, and they'd done a little video of their history with, and it was all positive things, positive. So I said, has anything ever gone wrong? And everybody laughed. But actually, it's really important because it's the problems, and it's, you know, if you've survived the problems, you're demonstrating that you really know what you're talking about. And also, your customers are familiar with the problems, but not with the solutions.
Yeah.
So if you say I'm a Reiki therapist.
Reiki. You always Reiki.
I can't even pronounce it. Never know. But I mean, I've no idea what Reiki therapists do.
I can tell you that, Chris.
Yeah, I know you can. But the point I'm making is that if you say, I help people who are in, I don't know, muscular pain or something like that, that connects. And it doesn't matter what the therapy is, you know, because you can connect through the problem.
Well, yeah. People want to know that you're human. That's the first thing. And we don't learn anything from when stuff goes right. People want to know, like Chris mentioned a few seconds ago, okay, this went pear-shaped. This is what we did to un-pear-shape it. And that's what people are interested in. How did you get over that? How did you deal with it? Did you get angry and frustrated, upset? Did you throw things at the wall? Did you scream and run away? What did you actually do to make it that work? Because it's a fabulous story, and in that story there is learning, there are lessons. Because if I want to do the thing that you've just done and it went pear-shaped, I go, right, so if I want to make my thing work, I need to avoid that thing, or if that thing happens, I need to do this and this.
Well, that's what I'm actually going to talk about with something that, because I write songs and produce music. And the story of how I created my new single, Trust the Flow, is kind of actually a story about how something was going wrong. So I was trying to produce a song and I was trying to get it sorted. I can't remember which song it was, but it wasn't going to plan. And I have found it very, very difficult to get music out there for many years now. And this is not just something that I struggle with. It's actually a lot of musicians out there, especially females who may have had problems of abuse or different things from males that they may not feel comfortable in the studio with and things like that. But then it's something I have to overcome, and I have, you know, made steps now to overcome this and feel a lot more comfortable in the studio. But I also wanted to set up my own home studio. Now, I didn't have a proper laptop. My laptop was broken. I didn't have a mic. I didn't have speakers. And all these things is you'd think that you'd need for recording music. But actually, I did it all on my phone. At first, not this particular song, but this is how I started off. I found when I got a new phone, because I even needed a new phone to be able to do this on GarageBand, and I started to produce on my phone. And then I finally got a laptop, and then I got a different program called Logic, but I was still having problems with the program, and I still wasn't able to do the song that I was having because I was just getting used to it. So anyway, I thought in that moment, I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to do a new song because I need a fresh perspective. I need something new. I need to get out of this box of trying to make this particular song work, whatever the song was. So I just went to a new page and started to project, that's the word. I went to a new project and I just started to press buttons and make a sound with it. And then I started to sing over the top and I just got this hook going, trust the flow. And I was like, wow, I'm going to whisper that. And I thought, wow, yeah, this is what it's about. You've got to trust the flow and not get stuck in kind of these mindsets where everything's going wrong and it's not working for me and this, that and the other. And then eventually I actually reached out to a mixing and mastering person that in Africa. I've forgotten which particular country. I need to ask him again to remind myself. But so I reached out to Martin's Hero, who's done the mixing and mastering, and that meant that I could then put the song out on Spotify and iTunes and all that, and YouTube, because what people don't understand is there's so much that goes into actually making a song sound like you hear on the radio kind of thing. It's not just about writing a song and singing. It's all the technology side of it, and a lot of it can be quite complex. So yeah, that's the little story about my new single called Trust the Flow, and I hope that kind of gives a bit of an insight to anyone that might be struggling as a musician, or things that sometimes if you are getting stuck, you do need to just allow yourself to be open-minded about the solutions for it, that there may be another path, that there may be another song that's going to come out, or there may be another person that you need to contact to get the song done. So yeah.
Well, thank you, Gemma. That resonated so much with what Paul was saying at the beginning of the podcast about overcoming, I suppose, overwhelm and perfectionism.
Yeah.
And of course, we didn't know Paul was going to say that. So I was wondering, Paul, do you need an anthem? Do you need a song to celebrate and promote your business?
Oh, I sing my own song. What I love about your story, Gemma, is three things. First of all, you didn't give up. Secondly, you probably don't realize this, but you kind of went back to childhood. You said you got this thing, you started pushing buttons and pressing things to see what happened. How do we learn stuff as kids? We grab something, we bang it on the side, we push the buttons, we pull it apart, we throw it around. And that's how we learn. And, you know, just the sheer understanding that when we mess up, it's a great place to learn. Too many people get frustrated that they don't do a track, you know, all the way through first time round. Now, I'm not an artist. I've never recorded anything. But I do know that these tracks that we hear on the radio or hear on TV or whatever, that's just not the first recording. They may have done 100 versions of that, or 200 or 300. The producer may have been in the studio for like an entire weekend. Prince is renowned for going into his studio and not coming out for weeks just to get one piece of music right in his mind. And I think that's a fabulous story, because it really highlights that if you are determined and you want to do something, you'll get there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm still going through it, because I've still got tracks where things are happening to them and I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here with the technology side? You know, there's certain things that are happening, but I'm not going to give up. I'm still going to, you know, do my best to think, okay, there must be a solution. Let's think outside the box. What's, you know, ask people for help. And it does take time, I think, to, and one of the things I've had to do is work with therapists and coaches to get over these blocks, because it's not just, you know, the external problems that you face, it's the internal problems, those doubts, those thoughts that say, I can't do this, nobody's bothered about my music, nobody would listen anyway, and all these thoughts that actually aren't true at all, because I've now got friends telling me how they resonate, you know, with my songs, and, you know, how certain lyrics or certain melodies that they really enjoy. So it's kind of like keeping in mind that if you resonate with something, there'll be someone out there that will do. Not everyone, but there will be people out there that resonate with it, because if it's coming from your heart and your soul, and you, it's something that you feel passionate about, there'll be other people that feel passionate about it as well. And it's just finding those people and sticking with it.
I think the most important thing out of that, Gemma, is the fact that it really only matters if you are enjoying what you're doing, if you enjoy the end result. And if you do it for you, then okay. If you don't find anybody, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, because you've done it for yourself. You've enjoyed it. You enjoy the process. You enjoy learning. You enjoy the whole thing about creating music, finding lyrics and melodies that kind of fit together. All of the really famous artists from all time produced music and creativity because it was for them. Mm. It was their thing. Picasso, he was working into his late 80s or early 90s every single day, because that was his life. That was his passion. He didn't really care whether people, you know, liked his stuff or he sold it. He just produced and produced and produced and produced. The ones that kind of, the one-hit wonders or people that kind of aren't successful, start making stuff to please other people.
The people.
Yeah, and then, okay, they may get one hit and it goes mad, but then after that is, well, what do I do now? Because they can't reproduce that thing because it wasn't for them. And once you get over that, once you understand that, then, yeah, the sky's the limit, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think we're going to play the song now.
Oh, could you give a little bit of it, just so we get a feel for it? You know, you don't need a piano or anything, do you?
Well, if I sing it. All right.
Just so we can get, so that Paul and I can respond.
Hang on. No. Gemma, what's it called?
It's called Trust the Flow.
Trust the Flow.
I'll sing a bit of it. The thing is, it might not be a particular style, but it's very electronic. But it has a, so it goes da 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 da. Da, 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 and it has a little da, 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 and then I go, it doesn't have to be about where you're going, it doesn't have to be about what you're showing, it can be more than you ever dreamed, it can be more than what it seems. Then it goes, trust the flow.
Ladies and gentlemen, I get the privilege and the pleasure of introducing Gemma's latest track, Trust the Flow.
as it happens, it's just occurred to me, as it happens, we're making this recording almost exactly 1 week since the death of Queen Elizabeth. And we thought...
That's a cheerful note. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And...
Well, he has a story about it.
I know he does.
Yes.
What
I have a
about
story.
The death?
But maybe go upbeat rather than downbeat.
Well, I just thought, you know,
we
it was
will
an observation.
At the end.
But I am going to go upbeat. Just give me a chance. I'm just in the foothills of the upbeat. Yeah, you've got to climb up. Now,
you've got to have the grieving process.
I worked.
Oh God, I'm going. Sorry.
I'm not grieving. I worked in Attercliffe.
The country is grieving.
Well, maybe, but I'm not.
We'll have that conversation in a bit. You talk first.
Right, I should try again. I worked in Attercliffe during the 1990s, and it was a shadow of its former self. Because for most of the first half of the, and more of the 20th century, Attercliffe was the community in the middle of the Lower Don Valley in Sheffield, which was where all the steel was produced and the munitions factories that actually resourced the Second World War. So there was a lot going on there. And in the middle of this community, there was a department store called Banners. And Banners was amazing. I can remember it as a kid. And it was the first department store in Sheffield to have escalators. And it also had an amazing thing, which all children would love even to this day. When you got the bill, you handed over the money, and the money in the bill was put into a capsule, and it went swoosh off into the bowels of the building. And then you waited and waited and waited, and eventually, swoosh, back it came. And miraculously inside was your receipt and your change. I don't know what the purpose of that was, but for kids it was brilliant. And by the 1990s, Banners was pretty much an empty shell, and we built a community cafe in it. But in 1954, and very specifically on the 27th of October 1954, it was still in its heyday. And it's, I think, no coincidence that the cavalcade bringing Queen Elizabeth for the first time to Sheffield started by coming through Attercliffe, past the Banners store with the flags outside of it, and a big banner that read, "Attercliffe welcomes our Queen." And you can see this in the video, the link of which I've put in the show notes. And from there, she went on into the city centre. Now, by some miracle, when the Germans bombed Sheffield, they missed the Lower Don Valley and so all the munitions factories were intact. But they did hit the centre of Sheffield, and people call it a tale of two cities. So she arrived there. Fortunately, the town hall was still standing, and she was greeted by civic dignitaries, and there they had luncheon. I can't remember ever having luncheon myself. I've had lunch. I think luncheon's just a posh sort of lunch. Anyway, they had that. And then they drove to Hillsborough, to Sheffield Wednesday. Not Sheffield United, no. Sheffield Wednesday's football ground. And that was packed full of well-wishers and an amazing display of presumably footballers in different coloured sweaters making all sorts of strange flag shapes. I couldn't quite make out what the flags were because it was orange and white, and I don't know what flags are orange and white. But anyway, they did that, and then they drove in a jeep. That's the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh drove in a jeep around the football pitch so that everybody in the stadium could see them. And then they went off to the English Steelworks. I'm not sure where that is, but presumably to look at some steel. And then they went to the university and the children's hospital, and all the ill children were sat outside with orange blankets around their legs. I think the film could only do orange. That could be the explain it. And then after that, she went to the Cutler's Hall, which is a really important building in Sheffield, for the final reception. It was a massive event, and I wasn't there. And I have managed to miss every other royal event I've had any opportunity to go to since then. Not only I wasn't there, but my mother wasn't there. We weren't very far away, but we weren't there. We were neither of us. And my mother was very busy. I'm not sure whether I was busy, but she was very busy. Because at 4 a.m. the next morning, I was born.
Well, you were busy being born.
Well, I don't know what... I think babies just sort of get pushed out, you know, they don't have to do anything.
Crying.
And... my mother was always sorry that she missed the Queen. I was 11 days late, and she never let me forget it.
Well, did your mum like the Queen? Did she want to go and see her?
I think she was... I think that particular visit, and I hadn't realised this until I saw the video, which has only just been this week. I've seen another video, which just did a little bit in the city centre. I hadn't appreciated what a massive event it was. It really was. It wasn't just... I mean, she's been to Sheffield several times since then, but this particular visit seems to have been because it was soon after the coronation was in 1953, so it was probably just over a year following the coronation. So, and I get the impression that the whole country was very much aware and alert to her at that time, and put on very big spectacular shows. And I also wanted to tell the story by trying to explain a bit about the city and how it was recovering from World War II.
Yeah, because I think that's the thing, you know, when I'm talking about grieving, I'm not necessarily mean like it's like a personal grieving thing, because a lot of people didn't know her really, but I suppose it's like a grieving in the sense of like having something be the same for so many years, and then it's like I was saying about trust the flow, it's like a change. You have to go with what is now happening, and you have to accept reality as it is. You can't sort of wish it to be something that it isn't. But you can change things, obviously. There needs to be changes made so that we can be better as a society and things like that. But I guess, like, it's just accepting what was and sort of appreciating, I don't know, what is. I don't know what I'm saying, but...
People don't like change. It's the biggest thing people are afraid of. And you're quite right, Gemma. The Queen was on the throne for 70 years, and now there's a massive change. We've gone from a king to a queen, and all the abolitionists have come out, and there's lots of toing and froing. People are afraid of change. People want to maintain the status quo. Go to any town in any place in the world, and look at an old building that's been knocked down to bring in a new building, and there will be people that will complain, oh, God, that building was so amazing, it was this and that. Look at this monstrosity they're putting in there now. Because people don't like change. They're comfortable with what they know. And for a lot of people, change is scary, change is frightening, which is why a lot of people don't do what they need to do to improve their lives, because it's too scary. The unknown is a frightening place. I mean, when we're kids, monsters in the cupboard, monsters under the stairs, monsters under the bed. There's nothing there, but our imagination is incredibly vivid. And so we think there's something there, and that is scary. What will happen if? What will happen if it doesn't work? What will happen if it does work? And a lot of my time is spent helping people to see that they are worthy of change. That, yeah, it might be the unknown, but it's also exciting. It's also, you know, an opportunity. And this is what so many people miss.
And I think one of the things I've noticed this last week, listening to sometimes feels like endless material on the BBC, is that the and it actually resonates with your story, Paul. The Queen, because she couldn't express a political view, which was a decision that she and others had made, she instead befriended people of all political views. And one of the reasons why we've got hundreds of representatives of other countries visiting this country for her funeral is because they personally met her. They had tea with her. It wasn't just Paddington Bear. It was including Putin. And I saw Putin's response, and it was incredibly positive. You know, he didn't take, you know, the opportunity that you'd expect him to take to have another go at knocking Britain. He was actually very positive about her. I thought, he's another one who's had the tea treatment. she became adept at befriending strangers. Is mourning, I mean, mourning's appropriate for her immediate family, but maybe we should be celebrating her past and her record, as opposed to mourning her departure. And it's very much the way in which we tend to frame it as a loss, as opposed to 70 years of gain.
Yeah, but it's like everything. People frame things in a way that works for them. Mm. Most people will see it as a sad loss. A few people will see it as an actual triumph because now they've got an opportunity to push forward their political agenda. And other people, like you were saying, Chris, will kind of go, well, this is time to celebrate her 70 years of service. But to be honest with you, I've stayed well away from it because I don't watch the news. I stay away from the news because the news is always negative. And this is, we're talking about overwhelm earlier on. People get overwhelmed because they wake up, they turn the TV on or they turn the radio on and they get the news. They drive to work, they have the news. At lunchtime, they watch the news. They come home, they might read a newspaper and they watch the news. And it's the same stories repeated over and over and over and over and over again. And the news is designed to make us feel, you know, miserable. It's all negative. Unless, of course, you've got the 15-second clip at the end and, ha, 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 look at this puppy doing these incredible things and thanks for watching. See you tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. So I purposely, and I say this to my clients as well, two things. Cut down your consumption of the news and stop doom scrolling. On social media, people have the ability to control their feeds, but most people don't. So they get negative comment after negative comment after negative post after negative post. And this brings people down because they allow themselves to be consumed by negativity, to be consumed by negative views, opinions, and thoughts. Everyone's entitled to their views and thoughts, but I don't have to watch or listen to them. And that's the big difference. And if more people would kind of go on a news diet, they'd feel a lot better and a lot happier. And they'd be able to actually express their own thoughts and views and opinions rather than those of other people.
Yeah. And I think we have a lot of, there's certain agendas which you can't be helped if you've got like certain channels or whatever. And I think the good thing about the internet is that you've got a wider range of options of what you can listen to, like, but at the same time, it's still influenced by the mainstream media and by, you know, what we're told is reality. And I think the reality is that there's something, that there's a lot of things going on that isn't on the news. And I don't know, what's that song, something like the revolution will not be televised or something like that? Like,
yeah, but the thing is, there's always something going on. Always, yeah. always. And it makes me smile when people go, look at this demonstration. Why is it not on the news? Well, because nobody's interested. That's why. If people were interested, it'd be on the news.
But why are people so interested in things like the royal family? Because it's like, for me, it's not about attacking anyone or trying to figure out whether it's right or wrong. It's more like we know what's right and wrong. We can understand, you know, the basics of human things, but it's just the behavior of like, why is it that certain people get lifted up and put on TV all the time? What is it about us that needs that figurehead, that needs that princess, queen, king kind of thing? Even if it's not within the royal family, even if we didn't have a royal family, we'd still put certain people on pedestals and expect them to lead us in a certain way, even though she didn't politically lead us. But, you know, like, even with politics, like, it's like, why is it that we don't have that sovereignty within ourselves to lead ourselves to really, truly communicate in a way where it's not about these figureheads where we either say you're really, really bad or you're really, really good and amazing. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, don't we need something where we can all be sovereign and all have that power within us?
We all have that power within us, but people want to be led. We are, with all due respect, sheep. Mm. You know, you get, how come a pop star who's good at singing and not necessarily anything else can then come on and talk about this or that or the other, and people will agree and go, yeah, that's really important what you're saying. He's got a really valid point.
Because the singers are great. No, I'm joking.
You know, this is, people want to be led. People want, and it's always been the way. It's always been the way. We want to be led. We want someone to tell us what to do, because for the majority, we don't want to take responsibility for our lives. We want to blame other people. I want to blame the Prime Minister for this. I want to blame the Queen for that. I want to blame the government for this. I want to blame my next door neighbour for that. I want to blame everybody else instead of taking responsibility for my own actions, my own life, because that's the easier route. It's so much more difficult to sit down and think and take responsibility. It's so much easier to blame. So if I've got a figurehead, yeah, they say do this, I go do that. They say do this and it works out wrong, I can blame them because they told me to do it. Because people don't want to take responsibility. And the few that do are the ones that make things of their lives. They're the ones that do something because they've understood from an early age that they want to get somewhere, they have to take responsibility and not rely on other people leading them. It's as simple as that. That's why we have celebrities. And, you know, the royal family is a soap opera, has been for a long, long time. Go back to the 1930s, before World War II. There was a famous divorce, and it kind of split the royal family and split public opinion. So, and it's always been that way. The royal family is a soap opera. I mean, people ask me, what do you think of the royal family? And I use a famous quote from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, mostly harmless. Because the royal family has no political power. They've got no, you know, control over anything. We just like to think they do. So, yeah, I'm ambivalent. She was a great lady, did a lot of work, but I'm not going to cry because she's passed away. And neither am I going to celebrate that she's passed away either, because I don't want to and I don't need to. If people choose to do that, then that's their choice. But whatever way we go, whatever happens, whether we abolish the monarchy, whether we don't abolish the monarchy, it's still down to people taking responsibility and not being led, because that's the only way you can grow as a person.
There's loads of things I probably want to say, but until I know the facts of what I'm saying, I'm kind of like, I don't know. I don't like the idea of that we ruled or still rule different countries. I think that's wrong. But that's just my opinion. But again, it goes back in. It's not just my opinion. I think it's something we all need to feel free, and we all need to feel that when we are led by someone, because I think we do need leaders.
Do we? Look, which government has led us well in the past 100 years, apart from, say, Churchill and World War II? The thing is, yes, this country and pretty much every single country on this planet has done horrible things. But that's history. Yeah. It's gone. It's done. It's dusted. It's over. People, if they don't want to be led, they have to make a choice. And most people have that choice, but they don't make it. It's as simple as that. And it doesn't matter which leader is in power or which superstar it reigns at the time. Yeah, people want to be led. Always have been and always will be. Look, a great and a very horrible example of this is Hitler. Hitler found a scapegoat. He worked that scapegoat till pretty much everybody in Germany was following him. And then he caused havoc for the next, several years because people chose to follow him. Now, it was difficult not to follow him, but people did reject him. People did rebel against him, but we don't hear about them. So it's all about making a choice.
Decision.
I mean, one of the weakest excuses you can ever make, and this we heard this at Nuremberg so many times, I was just following orders. And this because people want to be led. Most people want to be led. Most people don't want to take things.
They're frightened of, we talked about on one of the podcasts directly about, because there's a book about my family that's been written because they came over from Germany to escape the Nazis. And I guess there was just so much fear. Now, I'm not saying that was a good choice that people made to not stand up to them, but I can understand, why that would be frightening to do, because they could die. And I do think it is, it's not easy to stand for your principles or to stand to do what the right thing is to do when you have a lot of fear. And even in the smaller examples of that, where, okay, you may not die, your family might not die, but it's still, there could be a threat of being thrown out of a community. Like, I've had it in certain times when I've said something and I've been, thrown out of the group or, told I can't do this and can't do that because I've said something, So it can be really frightening. And I do understand people who, I'm not going to judge anyone who doesn't speak up or doesn't do what they want to do because, of that. So I do think we need to give a little bit of grace to people who aren't able to fully, be in their own power.
It depends what you mean by be in their own power. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's terrifying. Sometimes things can be terrifying. I talked about the lady earlier on. I've got another example of someone I interviewed, a lady who'd been in a narcissistic, physical, verbal, and mentally abused relationship for a long time. And it got to the stage where she'd just had enough. And so one day when he'd gone out to work, she grabbed her kids and one shopping bag full of clothes and she left, walked out. Now, the next few years were incredibly difficult for her, incredibly painful, but she made the decision to leave that relationship and put herself in a lot of difficulties. But she chose to because it got to a stage where she worked through her fear and move forward. Now, a lot of people put up with that for the rest of their lives. And yet, of course, what Hitler did was terrifying and horrifying, and people had to flee. And I'm not specifically directing this at them. I'm talking about people today who are free. In this country, we are free pretty much. Yeah. We can do, if I want to become a belly dancer, I can become a belly dancer. If I wanted to, fly an aircraft, as long as I'm physically fit and pass the test, I could learn to fly an aircraft. If I want to leave the country, I can leave the country. If I want to go to Speaker's Corner and say the Queen was a rabbit and, you know, Boris Johnson was the best thing ever, I can do that. Whereas in other countries, you're going to get shot or arrested or beaten. So this is my point. Today in this country, we can face change. We can do things. We can lead ourselves. But a lot of people choose not to because that's the easier option.
Yeah. I've been to Speaker's Corner, actually. I got told, it was actually the person that we saw at Speaker's Corner, the only person I ever saw at Speaker's Corner was actually a racist. As in, she like literally said to people, she said to my teacher, who was Canadian, she said, go back to America. And she said, I'm Canadian. But she said that I was wearing black and that meant I was an evil witch. And yeah, it was very, very strange. She was a crazy lady. But yeah, that she was saying all these very, very bygone kind of viewpoints. But I was really surprised at how, yeah, she could just stand. I mean, she was getting attacked by everyone in the crowd, as in not attacked, but, you know, they were speaking up to her and saying, look, this isn't on what you're saying. You know, you need to shut up, basically. But like, she carried on. But yeah, that was a strange experience. Not quite sure what the outcome of that story is, whether I can use that story in any way to show anything, because don't really have any positive outcome from it. But
well, it does in the sense that this particular person had a viewpoint and wanted to express that viewpoint regardless of what other people thought, regardless of the fear she may have had of being verbally or maybe even physically attacked. Yeah. And I think that, so even though we are against what she was saying, that person had the courage of her own convictions. And I think that's a really good demonstration of standing up for what you believe in, even though it was wrong, yeah, and actually getting out there and doing things. And we're talking about kind of free speech. In a lot of groups and social media and platforms, I have to laugh because, take Facebook, for example. People go, I got banned because I said X, Y, and Z on Facebook. That's completely unfair. I should have the right. Well, I'm sorry. No, you don't. Facebook is a private company. It makes its own rules, which you sign up to when you join that platform. And if you break those rules, they can boot you out. And it doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong, up or down, blue, green, yellow, orange, or whatever. If you don't conform to the rules, they kick you out. And this is what people kind of get confused with when they're talking about free speech. Yeah. If you're on a platform, you have to conform to those rules. If you don't like them, go to another platform or set your own one up. And so people tend to get confused about, you know, being free or not being free in this country. And I think we are one of the most open and free countries on the planet. Yes, we have problems. Yes, we have challenges. Yes, they will take a long time to kind of resolve. But for the most part, we can walk the street at night without too much fear. You know, I'm not going to get shot walking to the local supermarket. You know, I haven't got a volcano sitting out my back door that could erupt at any time. And so this country, we have very few reasons not to make changes, not to do what we want to do, not to kind of take time to think about who we want to be, where we want to go, what we want to do.
So don't you think also, though, traumas can actually affect, because that when I did the family constellations therapy thing and we did actually look at the whole Hitler thing and like all the people maybe in my family that were killed, or, you know, people that my family were directed, it's through my granddad, so it's still quite fairly recent, although it's in the past. But like, do you not think that sometimes traumas could, even though yes, we are free to speak in this country, but don't you think like some people are still suffering because of perhaps their parents' history or their grandparents' history, and that actually takes a bit of time. It might take, you know, hypnotherapy or coaching or healing to kind of overcome those fears.
Absolutely, absolutely. There are people out there that have suffered horrendously, and yeah, it could take the rest of their lifetimes to deal with. It's all down to personal perspective.
Mm.
It's all down to how that person sees themselves and what they want to do about it.
Yeah.
Some people kind of just want to live with it as if they feel the need that they have to keep it and stay with it. Other people want to distance themselves from it and move forward. So yeah. It's completely down to the individual. And yet, a lot of people are stopped by their past. In simple ways, like I mentioned earlier on with imposter syndrome and the pink bicycle, but also from, you know, physical, verbal, sexual abuse, all kinds of horrendous things. And that does impact on their ability to move forward. So absolutely, you're right, 100%.
Yeah. Chris, do you have any other thoughts on any of those things?
Oh, it's been interesting listening to it. I didn't realise my story was triggered.
Take that route.
Conversation. But I think we're probably close to the end now, Gemma. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good conversation to have because I think when Chris asked me to do the podcast and I knew that it was going to sort of bring up conversations where I'd have to face the fear of speaking about things where I didn't know who's going to be listening or I don't know if I'm going to say the wrong thing, you know. And I think facing that fear and actually just speaking what you think in the moment, even though it may be right, it may be wrong, but there isn't really right or wrong because it's just you expressing your opinion, but there is on some things, obviously. But you know what I mean? As in, like, I do think even for me, this doing this podcast was actually a step out of my comfort zone in terms of being heard and seen. And well, they can't see me, but you know what I mean? It's like actually speaking up. And I know most of the time I'm asking questions anyways, but when we're having a conversation like this, it does require, you know, going a bit deeper into these topics, which sometimes can be a little bit controversial or controversial, maybe isn't the right word, but you know, it's making people think differently.
Absolutely right. There's a quote I love from the book Dune by Frank Herbert, which really talks about fear in a different way. And I'd like to kind of read that quote now. "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. When it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain." And what you just said there, Gemma, it kind of highlights that in a really great way. Yeah, you were frightened about saying the wrong thing, whatever that might be. You were afraid of having to talk about things, discuss things that might not kind of resonate with you. But you've done it and you've gone through it and you can look back and go, you know what? Yeah, I was scared, but I've done it anyway. And the people that do make changes, the people that do kind of push themselves forward are the ones that kind of live that quote, that they see the fear, they deal with it, they do it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I read Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. That's one that I read fairly recently. Which one was that book from?
The book is called Dune, D-U-N-E, by Frank Herbert. They did another cover of the movie this year or last year.
Yeah, it's quite.
Is it a story?
Yeah,
it's set way in the future. And again, it's a soap opera. You know, one family living a good life on one planet are told to take over this other planet, which produces a particular type of drug that is necessary for the foundation of the rest of the galaxy to function. And there's a local indigenous tribe that lived there, and this is something that they have to overcome. And the Atreides family are the one that kind of the central part of this story. Paul Atreides is the guy that has to say this litany to get past the test, essentially. But it's a really, really, for me, it's a really important kind of quotation because it demonstrates that fear doesn't have to hold us back if we choose to face it and, you know, face it head on and deal with it. Because most people that we see as heroes aren't heroes in that sense. They're just ordinary people like you and me who were scared witless, but they do it anyway. That's the important thing. It's not to let fear control you and stop you and actually moving forward. I mean, those people we're talking about in the 30s that left their homeland in Germany and Austria and other places to move to brand new countries like the United States, that was took on a massive amount of courage. Yes, they were leaving a scary place, but they were moving to a new place which was unheard of, which was what is America? Who is America? Don't forget, there were no TVs then. There was no kind of like instant coverage of what was going on. So they had to up sticks and move to a brand new place and resettle their entire families. And that took a lot of courage. That took a lot of bravery. So it wasn't just about leaving something scary. It's actually moving to somewhere that was completely unknown and could potentially be just as scary because they didn't know.
And that's something that through reading the book, I think the book's called Liesl, It's Time to Go Now, something about my family. So basically the story goes that my auntie moved to England from Germany before it really got bad, and then she helped the rest of my family move over. And the book has lots of different things in it. Lots of letters that they'd written to each other. And I suppose, you know, I talk about traumas of that be affecting me, but also your ancestors' courage affects who you are as well. So instead of drawing on, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to have a lot of trauma because of, you know, my granddad having to move over at 13 and everything and leave his home. But then actually, no, let's think about what about the courage to move? That's going to be also inside of you. If you have something that your ancestors have overcome, then that courage is also inside of you. So I think that's a really good point to remember, is that things that have happened to us in the past or other people, we can also draw on their strength, not just their being a victim of circumstance.
Yeah, absolutely. It basically learning about, you know, what happened and commemorating and accepting as part of your history, as part of your background, as part of who you are. I don't necessarily agree that we kind of take on other people's trauma. We can choose to do that, or we can kind of go, that's what happened to them, but this is my life and I'm going to learn from what they did and move forward. That's for me, that's the important thing. I mean, I lived in Golders Green for, I don't know, 5-6 years back in the 90s. And for those that don't know, Golders Green is a massive Jewish community.
Yeah.
And one of my neighbors, a lady called Edith, she was, mid-80s when I met her, and she had lost her entire family, mum, dad, grandparents, brothers and sisters, and immediate kind of uncles. And she was sent to England by her family because they kind of had an inkling what was going to go on. And she's the sole surviving member. And she wasn't the only one. I met several people through Edith that had actually suffered that way. And, you know, I really admired her because she'd got on with her life. She met a guy in the UK, got married, and lived her life the best she could, even though there was this massive trauma attached to her story, to her history. But she kind of not compartmentalized it. That's the wrong word to use. But she knew it, she accepted it, and lived with it. But she didn't stop her from moving forward with her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Paul, for being on the podcast and for opening up such a wide range of topics, and really grateful to have you on.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Gemma. I've really enjoyed myself. It's been fun.
If people want to find out more about what you do, where should they go?
Well, I'm all over social media, but probably the best thing is my website, which is ahappyhead.co.uk. So ahappyhead, all one word, .co.uk.
Okay, thank you. And Chris?
Yeah, still carrying on with all the usual things. You can have stories and sandwiches at the Island Cafe, usually a couple of times a month. And... It's all carrying on as usual. And Creative Hearts, you're still producing loads of music.
Yep. You can find me on all the music platforms and YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Gemma Rosenthal and creativehearts.coach.
So, thank you, Paul, and goodbye.